Well, if any of you decide to doze off, just keep in mind that Sally has a box of noise-making instruments that she can use at any moment. Well, Sally and I realized yesterday that this would be the first time we have helped craft and lead a service together. So thanks for unwittingly being our subjects today. I can't say enough about how grateful I am to this place for continuing to offer my wife space to grow as a minister, and I've been nothing short of effusive witnessing her thrive here. And if by the end of my sermon you realize that you like her more than me, I completely understand because I do too. A Unitarian minister, an evangelical pastor, and a lesbian chaplain walk into a bar. I'm sure there's a joke in there somewhere because you're already laughing, but I shudder at the potential punchline, so I'm not even going to try. What I do know is that for nearly 6 months now, a Unitarian minister, you might have heard of him, a pastor of a historically black church, a male pastor of a moderate Baptist church, a female pastor of another moderate Baptist church, two evangelical non-denominational pastors, one outreach and service coordinator of an Episcopalian church, and yes, a lesbian chaplain, have walked into each other's lives. And bless our pea-picking hearts, there's no going back. Consider us the spiritual breakfast club, an unexpected smattering of religious leaders not sure what to do about one another, not sure how to address racial, social, ethnic, and economic diversity and inequity in our communities of faith and the greater Greenville area. Willingly sticking ourselves in one another's company for half a year of full-day sessions, deconstructing, lamenting, offending, forgiving, growing, failing, breathing, praying, and listening. Listening to one another as deeply as we know how. It all started after Charleston a little over a year ago. We all watched in horror as 9 black men and women were massacred at Mother Emanuel AME, and the ripples from that high-caliber weapon held by a low-caliber ideology were felt all over the state. Flags came down and flags got strapped to pickup trucks, and I kept flipping off the store that sells those flags every time I made the drive up Highway 25 to the mountains. And yet, all that energy begged a deeper question. What now? And as much as I wanted to make it about those ignorant other people, as much as my white liberal sensibilities took pleasure in patronizing the world around me, I knew with only a few black friends in my inner circle and a whitewashed world constructed for my comfort and success, I had plenty of my own work to do. Several of us clergy folk realized that religious leaders in Greenville had no real coherent voice across lines of difference, no mechanism that helped us know one another well enough to respond together at a moment like this one. There was little collective energy that could be accessed, channeled, and activated. The reasons for this were and are myriad. A recent Greenville Forward poll indicated that the greatest diversity tension in Greenville, in fact 2 times greater, is not racial difference, but religious. We really don't know how to deal with religious diversity in the upstate. much less do constructive work together across any religious lines of difference. We siphon off, find our safe havens, demonize one another with vapid theological quips, and the reality is we do this by pulling the same levers that any other ism has us pull. All these isms are merely different ticks on the same broken clock. So we had some larger meetings about what we were going to do. I made a Facebook page, and we emailed, and we worked on a letter for the Greenville Journal that over 40 clergy signed, and our little flurry of energy produced, well, something, I guess. But the question remained, would we go any deeper than an op-ed? Could we really do much of anything without engaging the harder work of being together, of listening to one another's lives and stories and realities, of knowing one another's vulnerabilities as religious leaders in contexts that might chew us up and spit us out if we pressed in a direction that wasn't welcomed, about the hooks that seem to snag us in the back and keep us from living into our prophetic witness in our communities? After several months of further conversation, a small group of clergy embarked on a different kind of conversation, hosted by Greenville Forward and facilitated by the founders of Speaking Down Barriers, a grassroots organization working to dismantle white supremacy. We wanted to see if we could pilot an experience, replicate that experience, and expand our collective imagination out of that experience. So we gave ourselves over to Marlanda DeKine and Scott Neely. Some call them our coaches, I call them our midwives, because this has been one heck of a birth. If you get the opportunity to spend any time sitting at the feet of Marlanda and Scott, I would highly recommend it. In fact, Sally told me they'll be here in January, I believe, so you will. They are writers and poets and painters and healers, and they don't play around. So I won't either today. I'll avoid platitudes and simply do my best to tell you our story. And in those stories, I hope to communicate a few things I'm learning about myself and about the transformational power of listening together. A few things I'm learning about why listening together is so stinking difficult. And a few things I'm learning about what happens when we imagine a way forward, not in spite of our differences, but in direct response to them. First, I'm learning that deeper listening invites us to hear things in ways we have not heard them before. And it does this by deepening our investment and intimacy. Because when a friend tells us a story instead of a stranger, it drastically changes the way we internalize and respond to that story. During our third session, one of the Black members of the cohort told us about the time not long ago he was at a grocery store with his daughter, and she asked for a couple of dollars to buy a soda. So he was finishing up pumping gas. She walked out of the store, soda in hand. As the cohort deepened our attention, he continued with the story. When I saw her coming out of the store, my heart dropped to my feet, and I started to panic because I realized she hadn't asked the cashier for a bag. As she walked back to the car, I looked at her and said, "Honey, I know this doesn't make sense, but when you have purchased something, you cannot walk out of the store without a bag. I know it's not fair, but because of the color of your skin, people might think you stole something. And if they think you stole something, they might call the police. And if that happens, you might not have the chance to explain yourself. Never, ever buy something without putting it in a bag." As he told us this story, admittedly, I had no idea where he was going. I don't know if that happened to you. Even when he told us he saw her walking toward him without a bag and panicked, I still had no clue what he meant. And I like to think of myself as someone who spent a decent amount of time doing critical race theory, reading America's sordid history on race relations. I still couldn't hear it. I still needed help listening. I needed space to listen more deeply. I needed my friend to tell me a different story. I've never once in my life thought about whether or not something I bought was in a bag. Never. I was at CVS just days after he told this story, explicitly told the cashier not to put my item in a bag because, of course, I'm trying to be sustainable. I got to my car and it hit me. That story. I was listening in a different way, at a deeper level, wondering, feeling, imagining, struggling with a perspective of reality that was not my own. This kind of listening was changing how I lived in the world. Or at least it was changing my perception of the world, even if I still didn't have to worry about plastic bags myself. Because I don't, and I never will. I knew now that my friend did, though. That members of my friend's church did. That thousands of people around me did. What else was I not hearing? This process has also shown me that difference, and specifically disagreement in difference, does not have to slam the door on shared action and contemplation, even though sometimes it feels like it does. There can be space and opportunity to do good work together while also saying, I don't know how to go there with you, or I can't wave banners in that parade. For example, your dear minister, as you might know, has a proclivity to get arrested for things that matter to him greatly. As we have discussed a cadre of topics that we could collectively respond to, one that we continue to come back to is payday lending, perhaps. The Right Reverend Job has made it abundantly clear that he and several of his friends are ready to get arrested and protest. And that's a powerful response to injustice in the world. It matters. It does affect change. It's real. But we also had to name that members of our cohort who are Black have a very different choice to make than Pat does as a white man. Getting arrested for a cause is a terrifying prospect for people of color, one that comes with potentially incalculable repercussions. I can remember my professor of Black Church Studies, Willie Jennings, writing a piece in which he wrestled with the decision as a Black man to place himself at the mercy of the state and be arrested in the Moral Mondays movement. He begins the article by talking about the one thing his parents told him never, ever, ever, ever to do, and that was get arrested. So amidst very different fears, based on very different realities, how do we respond as a cohort? If some of us live in worlds that let us do things others of us cannot so easily do, how do we honor, even still, one another's difficult choices in the face of these moments? How do we channel the power that may come out of that? Amidst the level of difference in the room, we also had to name the exhaustion on the part of those of us who held an oppressed identity in having to, if you will, educate the room. Scott and Marlanda shared with us a story about how white progressives, even with the best intentions, can get it wrong sometimes. After Alton Sterling was shot in Baton Rouge, many white folks doing justice work wanted to plan a vigil. The impulse was to stand together and respond and to let the city see that. Marlanda and Scott, on the other hand, found themselves in living rooms and coffee shops with black men and women who were terrified, exhausted, unable to breathe, depressed, crushed under the weight of another unjust death. They were battling depression and the legitimate fear of being killed. So literally, as they were offering care in a coffee shop to a black friend struggling for air, Scott was getting emails from white social justice workers asking why Speaking Down Barriers wasn't doing a vigil. About how important and essential a vigil was right now. White people wanted to gather, and black people wanted room to breathe. Room to be literally safe. See if we aren't listening. If we're always assuming that our approach is the right approach for everyone in the room, our work will be stifled. And unfortunately, we'll perpetuate many of the things we profess we want to avoid. This discovery has been especially painful. I've eyed the door more times than I wish to confess during our day-long sessions. It's painful to gather with a group of clergy I love and respect and value, people I think are doing beautiful work in the world, and still have to tell them, I know my wedding wouldn't have happened in your church. I know I can't preach as I am, as who I am in your congregation. Why does it matter that we expose these places of difference and ultimately these places of pain and vulnerability to each other? Why does it matter that I name my grief over the fact that as a woman in a same-sex marriage, my chances of being hired as a minister at almost every congregation represented in our circle in Greenville is slim to none? Why does it matter that I also listen deeply to each story of exclusion, uncertainty, pain, and isolation around me? Well, because white supremacy deep fried in patriarchy is no joke. It is insidious and powerful, rooted in agents of authority that have subsisted for centuries. And its greatest weapon is denial. This denial diminishes compassion, dehumanizes others, all the while allowing people with privilege in the room to say, that's not really happening. The great myth of white supremacy tells all of us, white, black, Latino, that if we have a slice of the whiteness pie, we will be safer and more secure in the face of a seemingly volatile and unsafe world. As Americans, we have spent countless amounts of energy and resources building that identity up, feeding this furry friend, whether we always know it or not. And let me be clear, this furry friend is a monster consuming our souls. Just this last week, we met for our fifth session. We're getting there. And we started the day with a video of a group of diverse men, Asian, Hispanic, black, and white, wrestling with what it means to be American, how they define themselves in light of the American construct. The men of color in the room each described the ways in which it felt really hard to call themselves American, the ways in which their experience of fear and oppression made them feel unsafe and unseen in a world that was not constructed for their thriving. After we watched the video, I shared a story between tears about my own wrestling with whiteness. When I was 8 or 9, I have a vivid memory of taking a standardized test. Woo, so fun. Before we could begin, we had to fill out a form with what you'd expect: name, age, race, gender, etc. As a child born to an Anglo-Saxon father and a Puerto Rican mother, I found myself consternating over the race-ethnicity box. Above this line, the sentence, "Check only one box." It hung over me like a guillotine. I was going to have to pull the lever and pick one box. I remember checking white. Why did I check white? We spoke Spanish at home. We ate arroz con gandules. We sang Dame la Mano Paloma at Christmas. I spent summers on the island basking in the Latin sun. I was proud of my heritage. But I'd heard people make fun of my half-brother with a Hispanic last name that sounded different from mine. I'd heard people jab at my mom's accent. I'd heard people in my tiny hometown in Southeast Texas say how tired they were of immigrants taking their jobs. I'd heard enough to know it was safer to just check white. Amidst all the subconscious swirling, I remember raising my hand and asking if I could go to the restroom. I braced myself over the bathroom sink, took a long, hard look in the mirror, and threw up. Heaven knows there's way more to unpack here. A dozen other stories I should be telling you instead of the ones I told you today about our experience these last 6 months, about the experiences of all of our neighbors. About the vigil gender benders planned within a few short hours of the shooting in Orlando. About how I showed up there because in our second session, we'd watched a video of the sheriff of Spartanburg, Chuck Wright, indicate that he would physically assault a transgender woman if he saw her going in the same restroom as his wife. About how I flipped my you-know-what when I saw that video and called Scott Neely to see what we could do. About how that led to a conversation with Ivy Hill at Gender Benders. About how that conversation led me to attend the vigil that afternoon, about how Ivy asked me to say something at the vigil, about how after the vigil, more queer people than I can remember came up and asked me, "Where is your church? I've been looking so long for a safe space where I can be who I am, practice my faith," about how I emailed my clergy cohort earlier that day to tell them I was attending, about how I saw Trenton, one of the evangelical non-denominational pastors, standing with a town square full of transgender people and gay and lesbian couples, about how I wept later that night when he posted a picture of me speaking on Facebook, and I imagine what his friend circle might have thought when they saw it on their news feed, about the million and one ways we can mend this world if we just sit together long enough to listen. I could tell you about the day we did the privilege walk and took one step forward and one step back based on our answers to questions like, "I've never had to worry that I would lose my job based on my race," or "I've never worried about having enough to eat for the day." How we started out in one straight line, clergy cohort holding hands, only to watch our white men make their way forward and forward and forward, while our black cohort members kept taking steps backwards and backwards and backwards, the chain of our hands long broken. And I could tell you what it felt like when Frances, who was about my age and female and white, wouldn't let go of my hand, even as the questions around sexual orientation were stretching us apart. At one point, she exclaimed to me, "I will not let you go." And I thought to myself, good God, if something would incite us to start saying that on one another's behalf, where would we be now? I will not let you go. See, there's no way I can unpack what's happened to all of us in 6 months. Which, of course, is why the actual Breakfast Club just ends with a silent montage and the background song, Don't You Forget About Me. I have no clue what's next for us. I don't know how to answer the question that keeps coming, so what are you all going to do anyway? Well, we're going to keep meeting and listening and not denying and not forgetting and rooting any action we take in the honest, painful work we are doing together. At least that's the best this lesbian, half-Hispanic, recovering white supremacist chaplain has got for now.